What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have like a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
5-hour tea with caffeine from green tea leaves. It's delicious, energizing, and comes in three amazing flavors. With zero sugar and 4 calories, it fits your life. With its compact size and portability, it goes where you go, to the campsite, the hiking trail, the beach, without weighing you down. 5-hour tea, caffeine from green tea leaves. Release your natural side from the makers of 5-hour energy. For more information, visit 5hourenergy.com.
Take the bass line out.
Let it bump, though. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Hardwood Knox podcast. I am Dan Favalli, coming at you this time without Andy Bailey. And I am, however, pleased to be joined by NBA Math's own Tony East, who also writes for Def Pen Hoops. And he is the co-host for the Locked On Pacers podcast, which you should definitely check out and give a subscription and rating over there. We are actually more excited than normal to have Tony on because we've already tried to have him on for what is about to be our Washington Wizards season preview. I pulled him on here. This was a couple weeks ago. I made him record about an hour-long podcast, a little bit less, only to find out that there was some serious recording technical difficulties that were unable.
5-hour tea with caffeine from green tea leaves. It's delicious, energizing, and comes in three amazing flavors. With zero sugar and 4 calories, it fits your life. With its compact size and portability, it goes where you go, to the campsite, the hiking trail, the beach, without weighing you down. 5-hour tea, caffeine from green tea leaves. Release your natural side from the makers of 5-hour energy. For more information, visit 5hourenergy.com.
To be enhanced via editing, so we are going to do this. This is take two for us, so we're happy that he agreed to come back after that folly. So how are you doing today, Tony, now that it's round two? Are you ready for round two of the same damn conversation?
Yeah, I'm sorry I was recording from a cave last time. I'll make sure to not be in the cave this time.
You know, if you were actually in a cave, I would have just, because I would have published it and been like, hey, he was in a cave spelunking and he decided to record a podcast. That's how the audio quality is.
I was spelunking, talking about the Wizards. It did not go well.
You were Bruce Wayne-ing and NBA-ing at the same time. That's been hella impressive to me.
I was. Dan did not say this in the intro, but my Wizards knowledge comes from my old writing at Bullets Forever, which does not happen as much anymore, but I grew up as a kid a big Wizards fan because of the Anton Jameson, so I am excited to talk about the team some more.
Wait, that's really why you grew up as a Wizards fan?
Anton Jameson was the reason I got into basketball. Did you know he has 20,000 career NBA points? I bet you did not.
Yes, I actually did know that he put up a ton of points. I never thought of him as the guy where you'd say, well, he's why I started playing basketball, or he's why I really like the Wizards. That's unique. I got to give that to you.
NBA Live 2005, first player, Anton Jameson. Turned out to be the first year in an All-Star team, too. So did you know he averaged 19 points or more for almost 10 straight seasons?
I remember he did score a lot of points, and I remember when he was on the Lakers for a minute. I think it was the Lakers, and they just didn't really play him. Or was
last
that the
year
Cavs?
Of his career?
Yeah,
last year of his career was the Lakers. Yeah.
Yeah. So everyone thought he could still score at the time, but they just didn't really use him. So I remember just him scoring a lot of points. He just never would have been that guy that would have inspired someone to not only play basketball, but to root for certain teams. So props to you, sir.
Thank you. Yeah. I remember he got his dying season with the Clippers. He only played in 22 games, but he got enough points to break over 20,000. It was awesome.
It's going to go down in history then. Good for him. So future Hall of Famer, Anton Jameson was Tony's favorite player at one point. He was at least a big inspiration to Tony. So
It got me to the Wizards, which is what we're going to talk about instead of talking about Anton Jameson.
Well, these Wizards are a lot better than Anton Jameson's Wizards.
Absolutely.
So we're talking about a team last year that finished with the fourth best record in the East. They sniffed 50 wins. They got to 49. Didn't do a whole lot over the offseason. One, because they didn't really have the money. And two, because they didn't really need to. The rest of the East got worse, and you still have your three best players in Bradley Beal, Otto Porter, who re-signed, and this guy named John Wall, who's now in a big fat extension. You have those guys in place. The supporting cast isn't terrible. They were able to make some kind of small-time additions. I like the Tim Frazier trade. You have Jody Meeks, which is, you know, that's a tiny Anton Jameson right there when he's healthy. Jason Smith is still there. This team is interesting. So what was the – I'm not even going to ask you the normal question at the beginning of what was your general impression of the offseason. Was there anything that specifically impressed you that you didn't think that they were going to be able to do even on this small of a scale?
Well, I think you – I should start by saying how dare you say they did nothing when they signed their best ever player in franchise history.
I meant addition-wise. I'll say – okay, you're good. They got John Wall locked up, which is fantastic. Bradley Beal will still be making more than him for the next 2 years, though, so let's hope they're still
– ha, 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 get the joke out of the way.
Yeah. and they re-signed Otto Porter, which was absolutely fantastic. Everyone knew they were going to match whatever he got. But those good old Brooklyn Nets, including that huge-ass trade kicker in his contract. This is off topic there, but I love the overbid Brooklyn Nets on free agents. The Tyler Johnson contract, their fault. Alan Crabb's contract, their fault, and now their own contract. But still, love what Brooklyn's doing.
My surprise, I guess, Jody Meeks is interesting because he could be very good, but I didn't think he was worth what they paid for him. So I would say my surprise would be Tim Frazier just because he's more valuable than the 52nd pick in the draft. And we would always joke in email threads at Bolts Forever about how the Wizards pick at 52 was going to be some guy named Cash Considerations. and then they ended up trading away Cash Considerations for Tim Frazier, which you would never be able to pay cash just to have Tim Frazier because he's actually an okay player. So I think that's a great value for them to be able to do that with their 52nd pick.
Who was giving Jody Meeks 2 years and $7 million?
Oh my gosh, who's giving Jody Meeks a player option when he hasn't played more than 35 games in like 6 years? That's an exaggeration, but...
No, we're just going to call it exact. I mean, he can shoot really well.
He's a good player when he's healthy. He's just never healthy.
They seem just desperate for, this is what we have to use. We have the biannual exception. Like, we need to use it. We need to improve the bench. There was a spurt last year where the Wizards' bench just statistically looked like it was okay, but they needed extra depth. And again, if he's healthy... You know, you put him alongside any other ball handler, whether it's Beal, whether it's John Wall, whether it's even Tim Frazier, he's probably going to shoot 38, 39, 40% from behind the three-point line. And over these past 2 years in which he's played a combined 39 games, he has shot over 40% from the arc in each of those two seasons. So a small sample size, but if you're going to shoot 41%+ from beyond the arc, that's going to help the Wizards, and I think they have the personnel to maximize what he would do. Again, if he's healthy, he's just going to be in the corner, or he'll be around. I call it the witch's nipple, someone told me when I was really younger. So, and just fire away, and you know that'll help them. So I guess it's okay, but who was giving him 3 years, 2 years and $7 million, and like you said, a player option, no less.
Yeah, that player option's a disaster because – that's the thing about Jody Meeks. Like, okay, he's okay. You just said it. Like, he's good. He can contribute when he's healthy, but he never is. And so the player option just literally has to bite the Wizards in the butt because they have no bench contributions. So if Meeks turns out to be good and can contribute on the bench, then he'll just opt out. And if he's normal Jody Meeks and plays 34 games and isn't that great, he'll just opt in and they're stuck with his money. So I just don't get what the goal was.
It was like
the third day of free agency.
I mean, can we at least applaud them for not signing Jose Calderon 3 seconds into free agency like the Cavs did?
Yeah, I don't understand that one either. But at least they didn't give Jose Calderon a player option for the second year.
Were you okay? You knew they were going to do it, but are you okay paying Otto Porter max money?
Yeah. Well, oh yeah.
I mean, I'm too, but it's just a question I think you have to ask because especially the someone like you, yes, of course, or you'll have the argument, but there are a lot of people who probably look at it and just think it's not a good deal, especially because of the 15% trade kicker.
Well, so, I understand thinking he's not worth the max because he's kind of like a role player, honestly, but he is a damn good role player. And you don't get 44% shooting, like, it's impossible. Like, I wrote about that for NBA Matt, that 40% shooting is just insane how valuable it's become in just spreading the floor and keeping your offense gelling. And Porter was 45%. I mean, he was unbelievable. And last year, he led the league in turnover percentage. He had under 5 turnover percentage. Like, every time he caught the ball, he just did something positive, or, like, basically he just didn't ever screw up. And there's something to be said for that. Adding value literally every time you touch the ball.
That's a hell of a stat, the turnover percentage.
Yeah, under 5% is insane.
It seems undoable when you realize what everyone else is coughing up at. I mean, he was also one of the 5 best spot-up shooters in the league. Effective field goal percentage of
60. Number one, probably.
Yeah, he was over 64. And so, I mean, if you factor in his volume, he was hoisting up more than 5 catch-and-shoot opportunities a game. And to post that, like, that's an insane number. I am interested to see, will it be this season, another season? Could his offensive role ever expand? Because if when you give out these contracts, you're trying to pay the player for what he could become. I don't know that he could necessarily. Maybe he's capable of becoming something more on the offensive end, but will they ever have the room for it in Washington with Beal and Wall there, and even Markieff Morris, who likes to go at it with the ball in his hands as well? So you're almost kind of making this investment saying, we're paying someone who's going to be an elite role player on offense, and we're hoping that he just erupts on defense eventually.
Yeah, well, so Scott Brooks is really good at getting the most out of guys and, like, making really catering to their assets and just putting them in a role that'll let them do what they're the best at. And what Otto Porter is not the best at is dribbling the basketball. And I'm assuming that's kind of what you're leading into with this, you know, his next step on offense. And you said defense, so I'll get to that after this. But, like, he never dribbles the ball. Like, he just doesn't do it. He catches it, and he either shoots or he passes right away. Like, he just never dribbles or drives. I mean, the only time I really saw him dribble in the playoffs at all was when Isaiah Thomas was guarding him and he posted him up and backed him down. And that's the only time he ever dribbles. So if you want him to become, like, the guy that all these fans are going to love and love watching, it's that, you know, he's a guy who can put it on the floor and really get to the rim and score instead of just shooting from three. I mean, he's a career, like, his career average is 9.3 points per game. Like, he's not some world beater on offense. He's just incredibly efficient and doesn't ever screw up when he has the ball. Now, on the other end of the floor.
Well, actually, to interrupt you, but towards that dribble point, I want to see if you can guess what percentage of his shots last year came with more than one dribble. More than one. Oh, what would you put the over under at?
You're interrupting me, so it's either shockingly low or higher than I'm going to expect.
It was a little bit higher than I expect because I've always thought that he was – when he does drive, that he was an okay driver. But I guess when you try and recall it, like, it's
12%? 12% is my guess.
You're pretty – freaking close. It's one of these numbers where you say it makes sense. So about 85% of his shots came with one dribble or less. So 15% of his shots came with 2 dribbles.
Dang.
Or more.
Wow, that is higher than I thought. You are right.
So you look at it, it's one of those numbers that is like, well, I guess it makes sense now that we've seen it. But that, you know, that's Klay Thompsonitis right there, basically.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, that's his role. It's just, you know, like, I can't say this is, like, being pessimistic, but it's just how it is. Like, Beal is an injury-prone guy, and Wall is an injury-prone guy. And eventually you're going to be stuck where, like, Otto, like, you're going to have to create a shot here. And he, like, that's not his thing. And you just pay this guy the max, and of course he's worth it. But you'd like to see him take the next step because, like you said, you pay a guy for what they're going to do. On the defensive end, I don't really know what to say. He's okay. I mean, he's not, like, awful. But he can't match up with, like, the LeBrons and the Durants, and you kind of need your 3 to do that if you're going to be a superstar, like, really good team. So that is concerning because they are paying a guy who can't guard the best 3s on a really good team a lot of money.
Yeah, they would seem more inclined to go to throw Markieff Morris on those types of guys than Otto Porter right now. But, I mean, he's going into his 5th season, and he's still – only 24-year-old, maybe he gets there a little bit on defense. And I like his versatility as a defender. I think he can switch a lot. They switched him more last year, it seemed like, than they did the year before that. I don't think he's the best defender on the team yet. Kelly Oubre might even be in front of him at this point. But I'm okay with I'm okay with – I would have been okay with giving him that. If you're telling me this is the player he is, like, I'm okay with them giving him this contract. I think there is still – just watching him on defense and sometimes how he does with the ball denial, emphasis on sometimes, how he's able to rotate and some of the different assignments he's able to take on. I love that versatility, and I think that there is – there's obviously room for improvement there, but I think it's improvement that's attainable. So that's a very good sign.
And we talked about his off the dribble thing. Like, here's how limited he is off the dribble. Like, teams hide players on him, and he's good. Like, the Celtics put Isaiah Thomas on him because he's no threat to do anything but shoot, so they could just put Isaiah Thomas, stand him on him in the corner.
Yeah, that's what you do. The teams do that against the Warriors too, where it seems like they're trying to stash players on Klay Thompson, who's a better cutter too. So that's just a terrible idea. That you say stash on Klay Thompson, that just sounds so stupid. But it's what happens. But still, I mean, that's fine, though, is it not? And we're talking about a guy – there hasn't been any indication that he's – you know, one of the things you like so much about Klay Thompson is here's this guy in his 20s, in the middle of his prime. He's already won a championship too, and he's okay with his role. And it seems like we don't hear that Otto Porter's expecting to be this huge – featured option on offense. So I like that if you're going to get a high character guy who is still going to work for you on defense, and I do, you know, there are those viral videos more so in 2015, 2016 of him, but he is a defensive worker a lot of times. And if you're going to get a guy whose defensive effort, it doesn't seem like it directly correlates to how many touches or how involved he is on the offensive end at this stage of his career where he could be somewhere else filling a more prominent role, that's valuable to me in itself.
Yeah, he does try. I cannot take that away from him. I mean, I think that kind of goes hand in hand with what I said earlier about how he just makes no mistakes on offense. Like, he's a guy who's all about doing the right thing. And, like, that sounds like I'm saying, like, a white basketball player buzzword, but I swear, like, Otto Porter's big testament to his skills on the court is that he does the right thing a lot. And even on defense, he does try, and you can tell he's making strides of improvement. You can see that over his defensive rating and just in general, his defensive box plus minus is over zero. Like, he does good things. He just isn't, like, awesome on ball, you know?
Now, we actually – this is a recycle conversation from the podcast that never was, we'll call it, or the podcast that will never be heard. I mean,
the Cave Cast.
You know what? We have to ask, what are listeners – what are basketball fans – what's going to be more polarizing to them? That – rap album that KD and LeBron recorded that never got out in full, or maybe it took so many years to get out, or are they going to wonder more about that podcast that Tony East and Dan Favalli and Andy Bailey did for Hardwood Knox about the Washington Wizards in, it was August 2017 at the time, that never gets out? Those
we
are
broke
two great mysteries.
We broke
right
the
now.
Tampering news on the pod, and no one will ever know that.
We broke so much news on the pod. We told you guys where LeBron was going to go next year.
We did the New Orleans qualifying offer. We nailed it.
Yeah, it was. They missed a hell of a podcast. I feel bad for them. But I did ask you this on that lost episode. I know the answer, but I'll ask it anyway. Do you think Otto Porter is already the Wizards' second best player? If not, question number two would be, is the gap between him and Bradley Beal short enough for him to bridge it by the end of next year?
Well, the fact that your second question included a specific player's name it makes me think that you know who the second best player on the Wizards actually is. The answer is Beal. Beal is awesome. Right now, Bradley Beal is my favorite player in the NBA, and I think he is better than Porter. I totally think the gap is closable, though, and that would come off of Porter obtaining that off-the-dribble creation because that is his worst skill of shot creation, like worse than his defense. Like he can shoot, and when people set him up, he's great. It's the John Wall effect. A lot of small forwards, Trevor Ariza, Paul Pierce, you know, you can go back in time and see it. You know, they get
Paul Pierce at the four in Washington was fun. Then he went to the Clippers and just sucked.
He called game, man. He was awesome. But, you know, the John Wall effect is real. And so that is a big fear with Porter that it's all about Wall. But guess what? He gets to play with Wall again. So you can assume he's going to at least stay the same. But if he does get any better, you know, I think the gap is smaller than people think. But I don't actually think he'll catch Beal. I mean, we've really only had one full season of healthy Bradley Beal to see how good he really is.
That's a red flag in itself, though.
It totally is. And we'll talk about that when I do my official prediction later, but that could be a bad thing this year, you know?
I'm not sure. I would probably I don't want. I would probably call Otto Porter the Wizards' second best player right now, or second most valuable player. I guess if you want.
No, I would say this. Yeah, second most important, but not second best.
That's all right. I'll give you that. Then it's just the thing about Bradley Beal, aside from the health stuff, and there is. I don't know that we necessarily saw it so much this past year, but he was just in the two previous times the Wizards made the playoffs with him. He was just like it was sensational at points, and just looking at his ability to kind of score and really take over some of those games. I expected more. One, he doesn't. I can say this. I'm stuttering now. I expect more from the offense when he's running it without John Wall, and I don't know that we've necessarily seen that over the past 2 years. At the same time, from having to do research on this from an article earlier in the summer, I think the most used lineup with him that didn't include John Wall last year ran 38 minutes, and it included Trey Burke and Jason Smith. So it's like, well, damn, what are you supposed to do with those two guys around you in that small of a sample size? So that he's a scorer, and he's pure, and his shot selection has improved so much, and he's just a great shooter. So I get that, and again, a great scorer. He's not ambiguous to the point that DeMar DeRozan is at this point. Like, he's not divisive to that stage. But I just look at Otto Porter and what he is capable of doing right now on the defensive end, and what you're able to use him as on the defensive end, and the way that the league is going. And I guess that's where the separation, though, becomes. Beal is so much better at what he does on offense than anything that Otto Porter is the best at, which would be shooting right now, because we know he's probably a defensive wash at this point. So I get the argument, but I still think I get it. I guess I would have to concede this one and say Bradley Beal is the second best player, but I think by far, or there's a gap there, and I don't think it's necessarily that close, that Otto Porter is their second most important talent.
I can agree with that, but I think it's hard to say also because, like, the Wizards have not been as good as they were last year for a long time, and at the same time, last year was the first time that Beal or Porter had been good, and they just happened to both be good in the same year, right? So it's really hard to say which one of their impacts was, you know, better served and more important throughout the whole season, because they were both good and they both played in over 75 games.
Beal is, we talk about how good of a shooter Otto Porter was. Beal has, like, his career low from downtown is 38.6%, and his career low in terms of volume per 36 minutes from three is 4.4 attempts. Like, that's crazy. Like, you really stop and think, like, that career low 38.6%, and then career low volume is 4.4 per 36 minutes in that year. 2014, 2015, he just so happened to shoot 40.9% from beyond the arc. So it's just he's a really good shooter, and it seemed like a switch was flipped with him. All of a sudden, it was just, you know, Bradley Beal takes a little bit too many long twos, and now all of a sudden, like, just the past two seasons, Bradley Beal just really doesn't have to worry about taking too many long twos. His shot selection has gotten so much smarter. Like, it didn't seem like it was this gradual thing. Like, it all of a sudden felt like it just happened in 2015, 2016, where you watched him and you were like, wow, his shot selection is just a lot different and a lot better.
It was Scott Brooks.
Scott Brooks has been there for 1 year.
Yeah, well, yeah.
I mean, I will say his three-point attempt rate, like, just it exploded last year. It went from 34% of his shots came from three in 2015, 2016, all the way up to 41.8 last year. And he cut out more of that long two junk this year, but it did seem like there was kind of this big difference from when you were looking at it. I mean, in 2014, 2015, it was about 27.7% of his shots came between 16 feet of the three-point line. The very next season, that number just plummets by almost 10 percentage points.
Yeah, I'm glad he figured it all out, because he was really good that last year. I was looking at B-Ball Ref when you were talking just now, trying to keep up and find all those stats you were saying. I think it's interesting his free throw attempt rate also went up. You know, he was getting to the rim more as well while upping his shooting percentage. I mean, unlike Otto Porter, he can put it on the floor and score too. You know, he just kind of has it all on offense. And the reason I would say he's more important is because of that. But you said the problem earlier, and it kind of makes it harder to measure his importance, is that he rarely ever played without Wall. And when you have two players who are that good at both creating for themselves and others, I feel like you have to stagger them, and they never did. So maybe we don't really know how impactful Beal is, because all of his minutes were with the clear number one best and most impactful player on the team.
We also, and this is more of a, like, me just, like, this is more of a feeling of yearning. I would like to see him like as the number one option more. Like even just look at like John Wall is going to be the go-to guy in crunch time, because why the hell wouldn't John Wall be the go-to guy in crunch time? But Beal hasn't even really come close to averaging more shots per 36 minutes down the stretch of games for his career to John Wall. Like there's always been, for the most part, I think there was one season where they were really close, and I know this off the cuff because it was research for an article I recently wrote. Just the gap is just there, and I would think that you would want to stagger their minutes more because of that. Like, it, not in crunch time, I'm saying, but like that's just evidence when Wall's on the floor, he's clearly going to cast a shadow. That he is this pass-first guy, and that helps everyone around him, including Beal, but Beal more than anyone's going to benefit from playing away from him. And I'm always curious, maybe it's because some of the returns have been lukewarm for those Bradley Beal solo acts, but I'm always curious when coaches don't do it more. It was like, look at Russell Westbrook and Victor Oladipo last year with the Thunder. I thought the whole reason they brought in Victor Oladipo was to essentially, yeah, he'll start games, but he's going to play a ton of minutes. Yeah, backup point guard, essentially, and no. Like not, and then not only no, but it seemed like they went away from it more when they were in the playoffs and needed more of a punch when Russell Westbrook was on the
bench. They were intentionally avoiding it. They were playing Samaje Christian.
Hey. That's all I can say to that. Raymond Felton now, comparison. So it's all good. But anyway.
This is a good comparison because Brandon Jennings is the Samaje Christian for the Wizards. I mean, he's much better than Samaje, but I mean, they would play him with Wall, like as Beal's sub, and it just sucked. It did not work at all. And it's funny you said crunch time shots, because there's a hilarious video on the fan side of Wizards site, Wiz of Oz, of this guy watching the end of game 6 in the playoffs when the Wizards have to shoot their clutch three and Beal's in the game and he's kind of open and John Wall takes that contested three and this guy's kids go, no! And they were all upset that John Wall even shot it, but then he made it and they were all really excited. But you got to think that, you know, if Beal really was this, you know, clutch scorer and, you know, could do it all without Wall, he'd get the opportunity, but he just hasn't. And I'm sure that the smarter basketball minds than me, that I mean people on the Wizards, not just like Zach Lowe people, like know the reason for that. And I don't know what it is, but I want to see it tried personally.
Is it just they haven't had the coach that's bold enough to do it yet? I mean, you're looking at Randy Whitman, and then I like Scott Brooks, but he's never been this really in – you talked about how he's able to get a lot out of players, and I really think that's fair to say. I mean, Markieff Morris might have checked out on half the other coaches in the league at some point last year, but he never did on Scott Brooks. They hung in there and everything worked out. But he's never seemed to be this very inventive type of coach. And how much of that was because you're coaching Russell Westbrook, who's not a very good system guy, and now you have John Wall and even Bradley Beal to kind of incorporate into that. It's just is he bold enough to try it? And now when you look at, oh hey, they finally have this, Tim Frazier's a competent backup point guard, it looks like Beal might have even less of a chance to establish himself away from John Wall.
Well, it's funny because Scott Brooks got fired for not staggering Russell Westbrook and Kevin Durant, and now he's with the Wizards and he has the same problem. And yeah, you kind of nailed it there too, with like with Frazier in, Beal's not going to get that kind of run. But at the same time, you got to think of Frazier's in. You know, he's fine on defense. He's just kind of in as a stopgap. Beal could still be the creator in that unit if it was like a mix of starters and bench and Frazier was in with Beal. You got to think Beal would be the leader and like the guy the ball would go through almost every play.
I would think. But isn't it one of those things too, and you kind of alluded to this when you talk about smarter basketball minds, it seems like such an obvious what the hell is going on here, why isn't it happening, that it's almost too obvious. So like what are we missing that everyone else isn't?
Yeah.
The Wizards offense, I will say this, it sucked when it was just Bradley Beal in 2015-2016. Like it just wasn't good. They didn't spend a ton of time with just him. It was I think it was 450 plus minutes according to NBA Wowie, and their offensive rating was 101.4, which is bottom five efficiency. So it was terrible. But last year, you know, we're talking about a sample size of 320 minutes, and you're at 106.5, which is middling, and you think that's maybe a good enough reason to test it out more, but maybe they just don't view Beal as that that primary ball handler guy, because he's a good passer, but he's not necessarily a great passer, and perhaps they just don't trust him to be that alpha setup man for more than a couple minutes at a time. Or maybe this is just some huge, elaborate, gradual game that they're working toward, and they're bringing him along very slowly, and next year he'll get like 500 minutes without John Wall, and the offense would have ranked like 13th in efficiency or something. I don't know.
Scott Brooks is playing 4D chess and not revealing his playbook years at a time.
He's been planning for this job while he was with the Thunder, and that's why Bradley Beal hasn't gotten more time away from Wall. They knew this was going to happen.
They knew it was coming. Yeah. Again, like almost with the Thunder, it seemed like they were intentionally going away from it in the playoffs when, like, Brandon Jennings and Wall are in, and it is just going horribly. Like, even the Hawks were able to score, like, so well when Brandon Jennings was in the game, and yet they would still do it, and I don't understand it.
And that's
like
just everyone knows, that's one of the worst insults that you could suffer, that last year's Hawks offense, specifically end-of-the-season Hawks offense, was able to score on you. But go on, yeah, sorry to interrupt.
And score well. No. You're exactly right. That's the reason I put so much emphasis on that, because the Hawks were a defensive-minded team, and not defensive-minded, like entirely defensive-focused on success team. And yet they were able to score like pretty dang well when Jennings was out there. And I thought the whole point of bringing in Jennings midseason is like, finally we have a backup for Wall that Beal can play with. And instead he became Beal's backup. And I just didn't understand it. And it was so weird. And it was awful. Like, that was one of the worst defensive groups they could have had. And Brandon Jennings' skills aren't really cohesive with Walls at all. Like, the ball was just kind of flying around everywhere, but not in a good way. It was bad.
Did you, when you said Brandon Jennings skills, did you use bunny quotes on skills?
Yeah, air quotes.
That's what
yeah,
that's what you did in my head.
There's a reason he's in China.
This is it's semi on topic, but they're semi again. My favorite word since we started podcasting, apparently. The moment between, it was just funny, like at the beginning of the season, there was the reports of the beef or like the discord between Beal and John Wall. And then in the playoffs, when John Wall hit that game winner to force game 7 against the Celtics, and he jumped on the scorers table, and then those two did their podium interviews together, and Bradley Beal didn't realize that John Wall jumped on the table, and his reaction to finding out was just priceless. And I was like, these two look like friends now. And maybe we like that as an illusion, but that was one of my favorite moments of the season. Like that collective whole series leading up to it. Like, these are two guys that were supposed to have issues, which is, I guess it kind of makes sense if you have two, they call themselves alphas, but at the same time, their games complement one another so well. It's like, well, damn, can't you guys just get along? And then we fast forward 10 months or whatever it was, and John Wall's, maybe it's just because the moment was so uplifting, but John Wall's jumping on a table, and Bradley Beal looks like he's about to snort water out of his nose when he finds out.
I think winning really brings guys together, and it kind of, when you're winning so much, it kind of hides those, locker room problems, because early on in the year when they were, 2-8 and 4-15, and they just did not look like a good team. We can kind of talk about how their season was like three seasons if we want to later, but, you know, those stories were kind of looming in the back, like, oh, maybe they'd be winning if John Wall was passing to Bradley Beal more and all this stuff like that. But then they went on that crazy run in, like, January and February, and all of a sudden it became like, who could have thought these guys weren't friends? You know, they're setting each other up and scoring all these points, and I can't tell if that was overblown or if winning just really got rid of that story and then they became tight because they realized how well they could play together. But I think it was more of an overblown, they don't have chemistry thing than they actually want friends.
Well, it could have just been a poor choice of words on John Wall's behalf.
I agree.
That was the thing that started all of it. Although, I don't know, John Wall seems like a smart guy, and I remember him talking about Paul George very openly at the expense of Otto Porter, basically. So, and it's funny that we went down to kind of a Bradley Beal rabbit hole, because the first time we recorded this podcast, we spent minimal time on Bradley Beal because we went down in a Markieff Morris rabbit hole. And I'd like to dip our feet into that a little bit more, because his season was kind of – you talk about the Wizards having three seasons. His season was kind of three seasons. It was definitely two. There was that –
it's just definitely two.
But
well, there's actually two versions of – this is not a Marcus Morris joke. This is actually a thing. There are actually two versions of Markieff Morris. There is trying on offense and defense and very effective Markieff Morris, and there's just like playing basketball because he gets paid to do it Markieff Morris. And trying on both ends of the floor and rebounding Markieff Morris is like an elite stretch four. Like, he is amazing. And then the other Markieff Morris is just like meh.
Yeah, you can see when his shot's not going, it all just unravels for him.
I agree.
But it, that was a good – this would be the testament to Scott Brooks. It never seemed like he fully checked out on Scott Brooks. Like, Scott was able to just keep him there and engaged, and they turned it around, and he had a very good second part of the season. There was kind of a stretch there where he helped fuel when that Wizards starting lineup went through this weird statistical eight-game malaise when you look at their splits. He was kind of a big part of that, but he had a very good second part of the season. And you're right. They see when he's really on, they just look like a completely different team. They're still, even on his best nights, there are a lot of instances where I think you want him to pass more, but he can be dangerous off the dribble. He can guard a lot of different guys on the defensive end. I think Kelly Oubre is going to be their best one-on-one defender by the end of next season, but Markieff Morris is probably that guy right now. He's a big deal to this team.
He is. He can bang in the post on D and O. He can guard on the wing on D and O. I mean, he's a high floor guy to me, even when he's not trying, because he's just kind of good at everything. And it's weird that his like attitude problems got him forced out of Phoenix, and then thank God Scott Brooks could channel this guy, because he's been so useful. He can screen mediocrely well. He can shoot really well. He's just exactly what you want your four to be. And it's an awful comparison. I shouldn't say that. I lose all my credibility when I say that. But, like, he can do all the things that Draymond Green can do, just worse, you know? Like a Draymond Light, basically.
Yeah, like an emaciated Draymond Green.
Yes. Draymond Green who, like, took a drug that slows him down a little bit before the game.
Draymond Green's younger stepbrother, thrice removed by marriage, who's never played basketball before. That is Markieff Morris. No, but I totally get your point, and they use it. I mean, people just – when you see these types of forwards, that's the Draymond Green-like comparison is what people go to. Coach David Fizdale was talking about that with Jamichael Green last year. So, hey, he is that type of guy, and if you're going to have him engaged and he's going to hit his – you know, his – you can't really trust his three-point shot just yet. He was at – like he was good last year, 36.2%, but before that he was just below 33 for his career, below 34 for his career. But even that's not too big of a concern, because when you're playing with John Wall, even when you're playing with Bradley Beal, and the way those guys are so magnetic when they have the ball in their hands and they're driving and the defense just collapse on them, it makes him a lot better, because he does some of the stuff that Otto Porter won't do too. Like, you just see more of those like pump and dives from him. Like, maybe he doesn't fire off the, like, he sees a hard closeout coming, he's going to put the ball on the floor, it feels like, more often than Porter does. Whether that's just a function of his confidence or whether he knows that he's not that great of a three-point shooter is whatever, but he injects that little extra bit of versatility to you. And he can even be a guy, not a fantastic facilitator. Again, I think it's always, he's one of those players where you look at and you say, he's a pretty good passer, but he just doesn't do it enough. He's someone who can come in and just run some pick and roll and just be that point forward for very, very tiny doses.
I have nothing to add. Well, he can do everything, and he's not bad at anything. And what he also does is his skills are so – it's in a good way, his skills are duplicative of starters, because he can run with any unit. Like, he can be the pick-and-roll guy when Gortat's out. He can be the stretch guy when Porter's out. He can kind of be a creator when Wall or Beal are out. You know, he's like always the first guy subbed out, but that's just because when he comes back in, he's so important with the bench unit he's with.
And because he can do all these things, he's someone, and there's probably a question of will he be consistent enough on the boards. But if we're talking about teams that can play death lineups or knockoff death lineups compared to the Warriors and actually use them for these sizable samplings, the Wizards are up there because of Markieff Morris. You roll out Wall, Beal.
You just wrote about this, right?
Yeah, but they were good. They only played 52 minutes, that lineup of Wall, Beal, Oubre, Porter and Morris, but they destroyed opponents by 22.4 points per 100 possessions. And if you get the locked-in Markieff Morris we've been referencing so much, someone who's really going to try and clean up on the glass and really work his tail off on defense, and then he's going to make cuts for you on offense, and he's going to drive and draw some fouls on offense as well, that's a very dangerous lineup. And I don't think – it's fun to build these death lineups for every team. I'll say this. That was one of the most fun – that's some of the most fun I've had this summer, was writing that article. But there are very, very few teams – that can cobble together this collection of personnel to where you can say, well, they really should try and test that out during these extensive runs on the court. And I think the Wizards are one of them there. Maybe you have to hope that Scott Brooks has a feel for how Markieff Morris is mentally or just defensively that night. But that could be not just a dangerous lineup. That could be just a dangerous high-volume lineup to me.
Yeah, I 100% agree. You're right. Their 24 net rating is nuts. That's like impossible to find. That's like Warriors death lineup level of good. And it's just so stretchy. John Wall's going to be able to score, and he can do all the stuff a center does. He can bang around with your center. He can set good screens. He can stretch the floor. I mean, I think it would just work really well. And like we said earlier with Beal and his weird lineup stuff, I'm sure there's a reason they don't do it more. I just don't know what it is.
I think one of the things, aside from the Morris deal and his rebounding and maybe the effort he'll give you at center on defense from a night-to-night basis, I don't know that they necessarily trust, from an offensive shooting, floor spacing standpoint, whatever you want to call it, having Porter and Oubre together on the floor at the same time is really tough. Because when you looked at their favorite kind of like small ball combinations, it's we're going to put one Otto Porter has to be on the floor basically with one of these guys at all times. Or we won't even take Bradley Beal and Otto Porter have to be on the floor with one of these guys at all times because neither of them were reliable enough from beyond the arc. And if Kelly Oubre Jr. adds a consistent three-point touch to his kind of shallow offensive arsenal right now, he's going to be a heck of a player because he's already there on the defensive end. He's just suffocating as hell on that side of the ball.
Yeah, Oubre is, if he could shoot and not freak me out every time he dribbles and make me not want to watch the basketball game anymore, that'd be a huge step for him. His dribbling is awful. Like,
he's no horrific. Anton Jameson, I'll say that much.
No one is Anton Jameson, except for Anton Jameson. But so much of the Wizards' future kind of hinges on Oubre, so I would like for him to do well in that lineup just because, you know, they don't really have another way to add a good player. So if he can improve, that's easily their easiest way. But that's for another time, maybe like in a few minutes. But I think that lineup would work well if he could shoot better because he would guard the best wing on the other team, and that would leave Morris to just protect the paint, basically.
I think I dropped this on you last time, but do you know what Kelly Oubre Jr. shot from the corners last year?
Oh, gosh. Like 20%, 25%? It has to be awful.
18.5.
Yeah.
And that's where more than 43% of his three-point attempts came from, too, which is just absurd. And you know what's even worse is that 98.1% of his three-bees from the corners were assisted on. So it's not like... in theory, he's not hoisting up these ridiculously hard shots. I'm sorry. I knew that number, and I'm still laughing at it now as I look at it.
That's awful. That's truly awful.
The Wizards are scary on the perimeter now, and that was true last year. If they get anything out of Thomas Sadoransky, they'll be even scarier because – Bojan Bogdanovic, he was okay. Like, he could shoot off the catch really well for them. He'd create some of his own offense, but they didn't need him. Like, he was so bad defensively that using him as a small ball forward was just – it was a wash to worse because he wasn't giving you anything on that side. Do you see them leaning a little bit more on Thomas Sadoransky? Because Jody Meeks kind of has that Bojan feel to him. He's shorter. He's going to be a little bit quicker defensively, but he's not going to give you anything on defense. And you need to kind of hope that you just get a little bit more scrappiness out of your bench. And maybe he's that guy as a wing-sized player who can also handle the ball. Maybe he's the one. You know, we're talking about Kelly Oubre Jr., but maybe he's the guy that really gives you this organic growth from within that makes us say, hey, the Wizards could be as good, if not noticeably better, than they were last year.
My short answer is no.
That's fine. We'll move on.
My long answer is that it's just going to be too hard for him to get enough minutes to do that because you're right. He's 6'7", 6'8", something like that. I can't remember off the top of my head.
6'7".
Yeah, 6'7". He's got like two-guard, three-guard size, but at the same time in Barcelona, he only played point guard. And you could tell watching him last year that he was way more comfortable playing point guard than any other position. And he has no three-point shot to play the wing. So it's going to be tough to kind of put him out there. I mean, he's kind of like a combo depth guard guy, but there's no minutes for that. With Meeks and Frazier and Wall and Beal, it's just like not something they need particularly much. And I'm sure he could play the three in like the shortest amount of spurts ever if Oubre and Porter are on the floor, but they're just those two guys are so integral to success that you kind of have to play them too.
So you're at the point I don't want to see, and maybe I'm thinking from too
a big picture perspective too much. I don't want to see Jody Meeks get minutes over Thomas Satoransky. Like, I don't, if that, like, it, it's going to happen, and you're right. And if you're trying to win now, you know, Jody Meeks is a proven shooter. Satoransky didn't really attempt a lot of threes last year. It was under 40, and he shot under 25% on them. I get it, but I don't want to see, I think when you're in this situation, you're in the East, it's not all that hard to balance these kind of future expectations with the present ones. He's the one that can help you get to a higher ceiling than Jody Meeks. So I don't want to see him playing less minutes than Jody Meeks. That would aggravate me. Well, it's inevitable, but it's going to. So yeah. I'm going to say it's aggravating me already, and we haven't even gotten to the season yet.
Well, I think you'll see Meeks play more minutes per game, but Satoransky play more minutes because Meeks only played 30 games. I'm already being a pessimist about Meeks, but the problem with Satoransky is he's good. Like I'm stumbling over my own words here. In a way, like Porter, he doesn't like make any terrible plays. He's just not really like good at anything.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's one of those players where he sounds so much better in theory than he looks in practice.
Yeah, and we around the Dwight Howard paradox. Forever was our roundtable at Bolts Forever a couple weeks ago was about if we think that they're developing Thomas Satoransky wrong and they're kind of like using him in the wrong positions, which first of all is the most September NBA roundtable topic of all time. Totally out of things to talk about except for the development of a 25-year-old. And second of all, we kind of got like nowhere with the discussion because some people said like, playing him out of position, and some people said he's a second round pick. This is what you should expect from him, and it's just like no one really knows what this guy is, and I don't know if he's good enough to reasonably play a lot of minutes.
I would really like to see him traded to the Knicks.
He'd be their best point guard by a significant amount.
I'm sorry, but the Frank Ntilikina slander is off the charts there. Interestingly enough,
I love Frank Ntilikina. He's never played an NBA game.
He also, if you watch like videos of him, he didn't really play on the ball that much. Like I think he'll be good defensively, but he
thankfully has Carmelo Anthony to handle the ball.
Oh boy! And speaking of rabbit holes, but you get to the actual front court though. I have Markieff Morse in the front court. Obviously, we'll see Otto Porter play some small ball for Oubre too, maybe, but. They did sign Mike Scott, who could be kind of interesting. If I'm Scott Brooks and I'm angling toward versatility, like I'm playing Mike Scott before I'm playing Jason Smith. And Jason Absolutely. Smith just seemed to be on the floor way too much last year.
No more Jason Smith at the four.
Yeah, that's what is that? That's like twin turnstiles if you really put him on the floor with, I guess, Jan Mahimi at this point. I'm interested to see what could be big for the Wizards. You know, we talk about if they get improvement from Oubre, if they get anything from Satoransky, that's how maybe they can make a semi-leap. They're semi again. I need to call myself out every time I say that, apparently. If Jan Mahimi gives them anything at all, how big of a bonus is that? Like, that's just, like, anything. Because he is, that Pacers team was pretty good defensively when he was their fulcrum in the middle. Just, if he's that for the Wizards, I know you have Marcin Gortat, and I don't want to see lineups with Gortat and Mahimi on the floor at the same time. Like, I just don't want to see them. Like, those are two guys, you don't, Gortat's a good screener. You're not going to lose anything screening with Mahimi. Like, to have that in the second unit, that'll really help. I know his contract isn't ideal, but if he gives you something, anything, particularly on the defensive end, and he can still function as a rim runner, that's going to be pretty big for this team.
I was about to say, Dan, how far into the podcast are we? And when you answered, I was going to say, that's how long it took to say Jan Mahimi's name. He's become such an afterthought for the team. It's like a joke. And they just signed him for $16 million a year last year. I mean, they kind of need him to be good. And you're 100% right that he, you know, has all that defensive skill from with the Pacers. And when he played, I mean, look at NBA Math, which we're both right for, their TPA. When he played, he was a positive player. He was good. He just did not play much at all because he was always injured. And you need him to be good next year because as good as Gortat is and, you know, as good as his screening and offensive talent is, he's old. Like, he's going to regress. So if you need that level of production from your big men to keep up, you need Mahimi to play more and continue to be, you know, an okay to good level of player.
Yeah, who plays more games, Jody Meeks or Jan Mahimi?
My God.
That's like, it's a hell of a question. I know. You're welcome.
Yes.
I'll take it. They can't trade Jan Mahimi. Like, they would have to include a crap ton of sweeteners, probably a first-round pick, and then one of their younger players, and by that I mean Oubre or Sadoransky, and I'm sure a team would probably demand that it be Oubre.
Their only two young.
Well, that's what's so tough is this team can't really make trades unless you're going to break up that big. I'm going to say big-ish three of Bradley Beal, John Wall, and Otto Porter, which you're just not going to do, not right now anyway. Do you think, and especially because you know you're paying Mahimi, and perhaps it looks like he's healthy, do we start to see Marcin Gortat's name bandied about the trade rumor mill at all this season? He seems very consistent in what he does. You know he's going to screen really hard. He'll try on some defensive possessions. He's a pretty good roller of the rim. He's going to shoot a zillion percent whenever he catches from John Wall. But just looking at their payroll, knowing how much they're paying Mahimi, was that maybe even their goal when they signed Mahimi in 2016? Well, that seemed more like a crap. We didn't even get a meeting with Kevin Durant. Al Horford rejected us. We need to use this money.
We need somebody. I'll say this about Gortat being traded. He did say he was not having fun in Washington at the end of the season, and I think that is reasonable. But I will also say this about Mahimi. Of all those centers, you know, Mozgov, Noah, Biombo himself, you know, all those guys, he's probably the best one, right, of all those bad contracts?
Yeah. Among centers, he's pretty close to it, yeah. That's the best of the worst.
So he's not like he's untradeable, but he's not like totally terrible money. He's probably like a $5 or $6 million a year player, you could reasonably get off of him. But I do agree that Gortat is the trade guy. They are about $5.5 million over the tax. Coincidentally, Jason Smith makes about $5.5 million next year. But anyway, unrelated. I would agree that Gortat would be the guy that they would look to trade. If you ask Wizards fans and aficionados that love the fact that John Wall and DeMarcus Cousins are good friends, they'll tell you that Gortat will be part of a DeMarcus Cousins trade come February when the Pelicans have fallen apart. I am skeptical to 0% sure that will happen.
What in the actual hell are you attaching to Marcin Gortat?
Like Kelly Oubre and a first-round pick because they don't want to lose DeMarcus Cousins for nothing?
Nothing, yeah, mate.
Is the thought, but it's not reasonable. Yeah, exactly. Your response was the normal thought.
Maybe they're irrationally high on, like, Thomas Edoransky or something. I don't know. That would be... And you can't create you're not going to create the cap to get him in free agency just because when you're looking when you look at how much they're going to be committed to Otto Porter and John Wall and Bradley Beal, you're lucky because John Wall's salary is going to double in 2019-2020, but you're still looking at more than $70 million invested in Porter, Beal, and Wall. So you're not with Mahimi on the books. So now all of a sudden we're in that $90 million territory for four players. If the Pelicans are desperate enough, maybe.
It's not a maybe. That's not enough. Like, you'd rather have half a season of DeMarcus Cousins than that.
No, I get you'd rather have that. Oh, you're talking about the Pelicans? I'm just saying, they would have to be, like, the market for Cousins would have to bottom out. Like,
They'd have to be, like, 15 and 30, and he would have to, like, tell them he's not coming back and get fined for it and tell them he wants to play for the Wizards for that to happen. Like,
it would just be, I don't know. Or maybe because the Wizards would be, when we're looking at potential destinations, they're one of the handful of teams that could probably feel like they're assured of keeping him if they include two firsts in that deal. I mean, you're destroying your pick commitment sheet, but, you know,
But Cousins and Wall are so buddy-buddy that you have to think he resigns.
Right, you're right. So, like, if you attach a second one and you're giving up Oubre already and the Pelicans could look at it as, hey, Gortat and Davis will work, and then Gortat comes off the books in 2019. Yes, we have to worry about Anthony Davis's free agency, but there's the designated player exception contract, and Anthony Davis is one of those players where, you know, the DP has kind of had a reverse effect a little bit. Like, it definitely factored into the Kings jettisoning Cousins in the first place. The same thing with Butler. The Pacers wanted to keep Paul George, but if he qualified for that next year, I don't know that they want to pay him $200+ million. So maybe the Pelicans can talk themselves into that so that they're able to tread water for a year. They have these picks, this young player in Kelly Oubre, and then you can hopefully gain some flexibility in 2019 to rebuild around him. I don't know. I just wouldn't see it. I would love to see Cousins and John Wall play together. I don't see it happening. But it's good to know that Wizards fans are apparently incredibly high on Marcin Gortat. Who once autographed a baby. Do you remember that story? One of my favorite anecdotes.
I do. I will also say that Marcin Gortat's skills, probably outside of Golden State, could not be better used than on the Wizards.
That is absolutely – again, I need to look up these numbers. I probably looked them up a million times now, but he shoots, and I think this is exact – roughly 2 jillion percent whenever John Wall passes Tim.
Did you carry the zero there with your rounding?
Oh, that's fair. Maybe 2 jillion percent point one.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
he's good on the Wizards. He would not be as good anywhere else, and that makes him hard to
except
trade.
Except for a Suns team that had a healthy Steve Nash. That was just remember he was just like buried 20 feet under Dwight Howard in Orlando, and then all of a sudden he's in Phoenix and he's really good and he's
balling.
In Washington. He's good. Yeah. So, two questions before we put the bow on this. My first one would be John Wall. I don't necessarily like asking these questions, but when you look at stars, he seems to be kind of a divisive star himself. Because would you call him a top 10 player? Where do you think he ranks on the point guard pantheon right now? He's really good. And whatever you say and whatever I would say, John Wall's really good. Like he's really, really good. But there seems to be some – there's never universal agreement on anybody, really, but there seems to be just a especially high amount of confusion tethered to John Wall's stock. So I'm kind of interested on those two fronts. Would you call him a top 10 player? Where does he rank if you don't? And where do you think he ranks in that point guard ladder?
I would not call John Wall a top 10 player.
Thank you.
I would call him a top 15 to 20 player. Point guards, I would put him third behind Curry and Paul, Chris Paul. And I don't know of anyone else you could – oh, and Russell Westbrook. I'm sorry, fourth.
We would have – I'm not going to use finally James Harden's a shooting guard again. That could have gotten weird if Chris Paul wasn't on the Rockets.
Oh, right. Okay, well, last year
– No, James I'm saying we don't have to use it because James Harden's not a point guard anymore.
Right. Okay, well, last year when he played point guard, I would have put him up there too. But whatever. Those are the guys I put above him. He's probably – I just did a player rankings for fun this week, and I put him 13 right between Paul George and Gobert. He's that good.
But John Wall is really good. I caught shit on Twitter a couple months ago because I said I would rather have Kyle Lowry than John Wall on my team right now. And that was just because I still think he's just the easier guy to fit in. And you've talked to me before. If you're starting a franchise from scratch, maybe Wall's the guy you want, but I like guys who fit, and I would probably take for a season right now. And if it was last year, I mean, yes, Kyle Lowry ran into the health problems. I still would take Kyle Lowry just in that vacuum for that one season. If you're starting a team from scratch, there's just no question to me, but I like how easy it seems like Kyle Lowry could fit in anywhere.
I'm glad we're close to the end here, and I can't yell at you for that and make you pivot away.
I mean, you can yell. That's fine. That's totally cool with me.
I just think John Wall's the best transition point guard in the NBA. What is Kyle Lowry the best at? Like,
I would take in a defensive matchup, even though Kyle Lowry's undersized, I might take him there too. Yeah. I love Kyle Lowry's shooting. I think he's an underrated.
Hey, according to people on Twitter recently, John Wall's the best two-way player in the NBA, which is hilarious.
I did not see that, and I'm glad I didn't see that. That's kind of on – it's still not – like, that's the whole, like, oh, Russell Westbrook's a good defender because his defensive rebounds are through the roof.
No, I'm sorry. That it was a bad joke, but people were saying that he's not – he's and not even – I can't believe he even got an all-defense vote. He was not very good on defense.
I don't – yeah, he wasn't. I don't like, though, that people detract from – this isn't even just John Wall, but because you put these – expectations that are just too ambitious on players. To say John Wall's the best two-way player in the league or to say he's a top five player, it's not fair to John Wall because it's not true. And now you create these debates where we have to say, shut up because you're wrong. I mean, like they did this, like they just do this. People do this in general. I don't know who I'm saying, including, but people just seem to do this where they did it with Kristaps Porzingis as a rookie. Like, it's like, no, yes, Karl-Anthony Towns was way better. And yes, you know what? I don't think he played as much, but Nikola Jokic was better during his rookie season than Kristaps Porzingis too. And it's like you saddle these players with these expectations that they're not meeting at the moment, and you put smart people, reasonable people, in a position to where they have to detract from someone who doesn't deserve it, because John Wall is one of the 15 best players in the NBA right now. And if you take that as an insult, you're an irrational person, and that's just where I land on that. So regardless of what you feel about my Kyle Lowry take, that's fine. Like, but if you take issue to anyone saying that John Wall is a top 15 player, or John Wall is not the best two-way player, or John Wall was bad on defense last season, like come on.
Yeah, I just have Lowry like 10 spots below Wall.
I don't think he's that low, but I have notoriously been a lot higher on Kyle Lowry than
I think Kyle Lowry's good, and I actually debated, like, my 21, 22, 23 was Lillard, IT, Lowry, and like you could interchange any of those three and I would not quibble.
Man, Damian Lillard's a hell of a leader too. But my last question before we put the bow on this would be, who's going to play more, Chris McCullough, Daniel Chefu, or Sheldon Mack? This question is solely exists because I want to make sure we mentioned everyone on their depth chart.
Well, you did not say Donald Sloan.
About him.
Might only be training camp, but Donald Sloan, important to note.
Donald Sloan is the Rasul Butler of Donald Sloan's.
If Donald Sloan makes the team, Oshefu or Mack might get cut. But if I had to guess who would play the most, I'd pick McCullough.
You know, that's fun, and that's leading to the question. Who is a player that you could get behind being irrationally high on this roster?
McCullough. Because they have the team option on him, and they need him to improve. They need it.
And he's just super long, too. So we talked about this on the last podcast. We talked about this actually before we got to the point of this second time around podcast. What do you have as the Wizards' floor, and what do you have as their ceiling? And again, just to remind our listeners, we're talking no major injuries, no major trades.
You can't throw no major injuries in with the Wizards because we haven't touched on it on the show, but their two best players are both kind of injury prone. With Beal and Porter, or Beal and Porter. Wow, that's funny.
Man, you're talking about me throwing John Wall shade.
Sorry, John Wall, you're not one of the two best players on your own team anymore. Their two best players are both pretty injury prone, and that kind of is concerning. I mean, they both played over 70 games last year, but that's rare. I mean, John Wall had that game under 50, and his first three seasons were all under 70. And everyone knows how injury prone Beal is, and last year they both played so much, and the Wizards starting lineup had the most minutes in the league. You got to think that goes down, and that could hurt them big time because that group was so good. So pessimistically, pessimistically combined, they only both play like 125 games or something. That would be awful, basically. They would probably only get to like 43 wins if that happened, just because, you know, those two guys have such a big impact. And you got to think that, you know, Gortat misses time, Meeks, you know, all those guys miss time. Optimistically, they stay as healthy as last year. They only got better by adding guys. They didn't lose anyone important. The East got worse. I mean, you got to click on two wins or so for that. I mean, they could get to 52, 53. I would not be surprised by any of that 43 to 53 range happening.
I think the health thing is legitimate with them, and even more so the starting lineup. And we talked a lot about this on the first edition of this podcast. I know it would be heard. They led the league in minutes for five-man lineups by almost a 500-tick gap. And I brought this up, too. They logged 1,347 minutes across 69 appearances together. That made them one of the most used five-man combinations of the decade. And you can't, especially when you have Beal and Wall in there, but I would say more so Beal at this point. But you can't count on a repeat of that. And I'm not even sure that you can necessarily count on a repeat performance of what they did, because they were spectacular statistically on both ends of the floor. And they looked the part, too, when Markieff Morris was on.
They just got carried so much by that run in midseason, too, that you got to think if that doesn't happen, they're only like a 44-win team or something.
So what is your final number for them?
I'll go 46.
I don't understand. You said that, again, you said this.
Maybe 47.
Fewer wins than last year.
Yes, fewer wins than last year.
Wow, I just, how? Who got, like, are you just assuming these, a lot of these teams in the middle are going to start taking wins away from each other? That has to be the assumption, because what, who
okay,
in front
Otto
of them?
Porter's, Otto Porter's contract year is over. Marcin Gortat got older. Mahimi got older. Jody Meade. Okay, the only thing they got, like, better, like, look, they're better, is backup point guard. That's it. And that's not a lot to get better at when your team aged and you have a lot of injury-prone players. That's just not – they didn't improve that much.
I do not – I mean, their floor, for sure.
High floor.
Right, no, but their floor, for sure, is that I could – I understand how they could win fewer games than last year. I just don't – I might even – I'll put them at 49-50, like dead even with last year is where I think they're going to – I just – who got better – in front of them, the Celtics are overrated. They're better, fine. The Cavaliers, better, fine. But did those two teams necessarily get better to win more games? The Raptors certainly didn't get better to win more games. The Hawks are worse. The Bucks are basically the same, and we're not sure. They're one of those teams with that wide window where it's, oh, hey, they could actually be really good, or hey, they just won 33 games for some reason. Like, are you worried about the Heat, the Pistons? It's just, to me, I think this is a 40. We're quibbling over, again, three wins here. But the landscape of the East, to say this Wizards squad is going to be worse than it was last year, I guess you have to fully believe from your perspective that something's going to go wrong health-wise.
Yeah, I really do. I just don't think – you just said it. Like, the 500 minutes clear is nuts. And if that doesn't happen again, who knows how good they are.
Well, there you have it. Tony East thinks the Wizards are headed for the lottery.
That's the NBA Math-sanctioned official Wizards prediction, right?
Yeah, Tony East is responsible for all Washington Wizards predictions. He has already said that Beal and Porter will be better by Wall by the end of the season. Now he's predicting that they'll have a worse record than the Nets. So that seems like a good place to stop it. If you want to go talk to Tony about his scalding hot Wizards takes, please get at him on Twitter at TEastNBA. It is spelt exactly like it sounds. He is a writer for our sponsor, NBA Math. You can also find him at Def Pen Hoops. He is the co-host of the Locked On Pacers podcast. Follow that on Twitter at @LockedOn_Pacers. Definitely listen to it. I'm excited to hear him leading into the season. If you want to talk to me on Twitter, I'm at Dan Favale. That's Favale. You can find Andy at Andrew D. Bailey, also spelled like it sounds. Follow Hardwood Knox simply at Hardwood Knox, and make sure to give NBA Math a follow at NBA_Math. We appreciate ratings for this podcast on iTunes. Comments are nice, even if they aren't actually nice. Please subscribe. I will not be giving a shout out to a certain someone's name who rhymes with Smeno Poudre because Andy is not here. So until next time.
Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive number one, number two employee. Leave a message at the... Hey, Jamie, it's me, Jamie. This is your daily pep talk. I know it's been rough going ever since people found out about your a cappella group, Mad Harmony, but you will bounce back. I mean, you're the guy always helping people find coverage options with the Name Your Price tool. It should be you giving me the pep talk. Now get out there, hit that high note, and take Mad Harmony all the way to Nationals this year! Sorry, it's pitchy.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Wherever you go, however you go, for energy on the go, it's got to be 5-Hour Energy. It works fast, it works long, it tastes good, and with zero sugar and 4 calories, there's nothing holding you back. Fits your pocket, fits your backpack, fits your on-the-go life, whether you're going to work, going on vacation, or just going out with friends. 5-Hour Energy. Energy on the go. For more information, visit 5hourenergy.com.
Sugar Ray Leonard, Roberto Duran, Marvelous Marvin Hagler, and Thomas Hearns. Legends, whose four-way rivalry defined one of the greatest eras in boxing history. Relive their decade of dominance in the new Showtime sports documentary, The Kings, a 4-part series premiering Sunday, June 6th, only on Showtime.